Hi, Misfits. This is Kevin.
And this is Kate.
Welcome to Horrorwood.
It is a bright yet chilly day here in the old Chicago, Illinois.
The old Chi-town. Last night, I went to see a movie.
What did you see?
I went to the Music Box and I saw Late Night with the Devil.
I've never heard of that.
Oh, so it's a horror movie that's been doing its rounds at the festival, like the horror movie festivals. And it was getting a lot of acclaim around the same time Talk to Me was.
Oh, yeah.
Which A24 picked up and released. Mm-hmm. And this one was also getting a lot of acclaim, but it just hadn't found like a release or distribution company.
Yeah, yeah.
I guess I'm talking like I know it all about it. I've seen TikToks. take my word with a grain of salt.
Everything I learned, I
learned on TikTok. Tic-tac-toe. It was great.
Oh, good.
It's set in the 1970s, and it's David Desmalshian. There we go.
Okay. He's a Chicago guy.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Yeah.
He plays a late night talk show host in the 70s. It's Halloween. And so they do this whole show around like psychics and people debunking myths. And
then
like this girl comes out with this parapsychologist, and like she had been part of this cult, and like she's supposedly possessed by a demon. So they do this whole segment of like, we are going to have a live conversation with the devil.
Oh, you're not giving anything away.
No. Okay, you can see all of this in the trailer.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and the trailer is really cool too. It sounds like an old 70s sort of vibe, and it's like, on Halloween night, 1977, a broadcast shocked the nation. It was crazy. And it was funny, and it was really well done.
Nice.
So I can see why it's getting a lot of acclaim.
Shout out to that film.
Late Night with the Devil.
Hey, and we have another shout out today.
Patreon.
A new Patreonian who has joined the Misfit Murderinos, and this person has quite possibly the best screen name.
Really?
And that's what's on their profile, so that is what I'm going to shout out. So, Baby Legs St. Clair. Welcome to the Patreon.
Baby Legs St. Clair.
I love it.
Oh, my God.
Thank you so much for joining. We so appreciate your support. Honestly, like, I can't even... We truly mean that every time that we say it.
Every time.
So that's not lost on us. Thank you so much. And we are closing out the month of March with a cuckoo case for you today.
What's the case today, Kate? Do pray tell.
I have to say, this is one of the most, this is the most bizarre death scene I've ever read about.
What?
Yes. And even after reading everything about it, I'm still not sure what I think happened here. So I'd be interested to know your all's thoughts. On Friday, May 3rd, 1968, Geraldine Saunders phoned her fiancé, 62-year-old actor Albert Decker. The two had plans to spend a romantic evening together, a little date night, but she was having trouble getting in touch with him. After calling and getting no answer, Geraldine was starting to get a little concerned. She's not freaking out yet, but she knows this wasn't like Albert. She had just seen him the night before. They had attended a play together, and he seemed fine. He wasn't sick or anything like that. But she thought, I'm not going to jump to conclusions here. Maybe he's got work to do. Maybe he's tired. He had just returned from Mexico shooting scenes for the film The Wild Bunch and was also preparing for his next role, so it was entirely plausible that he was rehearsing, lost track of time, or fell asleep, something. So she decided to let it go for the night. On Saturday, when she tried calling again, he still didn't answer.
Hmm.
And she thought, well, surely I'll hear back from him by tonight. But she didn't.
Ooh.
So first thing Sunday morning, she went over to his apartment to see what was going on. And she was alarmed to find on the front of his door notes from friends who were also trying to get in touch with him.
No, that's not a good sign.
No, it is not. So she wrote a note of her own just to be like, hey, babe, are you okay? Give me a call. And she slid it under his door. When he didn't contact her, she returned to his apartment later that same day and saw that the notes were still on the front door. She knew something was definitely wrong here. She went to the apartment manager and said, hey, I think something might be wrong with Al. I haven't heard from him in a few days. Maybe he's sick. I don't know, but I need to get into his apartment. Yeah. So the manager agreed to use his pass key and go into Albert's place. The door was locked, but not bolted. And when they walked in, nothing seemed out of place. Nothing seemed disturbed. Both the manager and Geraldine began calling Albert's name, but there was no response. They looked around. It wasn't some huge, sprawling apartment. It was your typical one-bedroom, very modest place.
Okay.
They saw no sign of Albert, but then they got to the bathroom door.
Oh, no.
It was locked, but the manager was able to bust the lock so they could get in there.
Yeah.
And when Geraldine saw the sight before her, she immediately passed out. But before we get to what exactly it was she saw, let's get to know Albert Decker.
Decker.
He was born Thomas Albert Eck van Decker on December 20th, 1905 in Brooklyn, New York.
Eck van Decker?
Eck van Decker.
I love that.
It's nice. He dropped all the other names, though.
Sure. That's like three names.
It's a mouthful. He was the only child of his parents, Thomas and Grace.
Mm-hmm.
When he was in high school, he was in a few school plays, but he wasn't thinking about acting as a career. He actually had his sights set on becoming a doctor.
A doctor.
He was accepted into the prestigious Bowdoin College in Maine as a pre-med student. Bowdoin College has some pretty distinguished alumni, including several politicians, author Nathaniel Hawthorne, sex researcher Alfred Kinsey, and Reed Hastings, who co-founded Netflix. Anthony Doerr also graduated from there, and I just wanted to mention him because he wrote one of my favorite books of all time, All the Light We Cannot See, which was adapted into a limited series on Netflix. It's all connected.
Did you watch it?
No, because I love the book so much.
You don't want to spoil it.
Yeah, I might watch it eventually. I know they changed some things, though, and I'm like, I don't know, because the book is so good.
Ooh, well, thanks for the rec.
Of course. So Smarty Pants Al Decker over there is like, I'm super intelligent. I want to help people. The best way I know to do that is to become a doctor. Somehow, in between all his pre-med classes, he managed to find time to play on the football team and appear in several of the school's plays. Which, he must have had some serious time management skills because, last I checked, pre-med is not easy.
Oh.
Just the time spent studying outside of class hours, let alone the time you're actually in the classroom, that can eat up a huge chunk of your schedule.
That'll take up your whole life.
So on top of that, Albert has football practice and games and was auditioning and rehearsing and performing on stage. So definitely no small feat. And it was while Albert was performing in these plays at Bowdoin that a former student who attended these productions as an audience member spotted Al's talent. He told Albert, hey, you're really good, and I think you should meet my friend, Alfred Lunt. Alfred Lunt was already a Broadway star at this point. He was married to actress Lynn Fontanne. If you've ever heard of the Lunt Fontanne Theater in New York,
yes,
it's named after them.
Ah!
Yeah. So this mutual friend of Albert and Alfred wrote a letter to Lunt saying, hey, there's this guy Albert Decker. He's really got something. I think the two of you should meet. And that meeting proved to be successful because not long after, Albert made his Broadway debut at the age of 22 in the play Marco Millions, which opened January 9th, 1928.
Damn.
Albert played four different characters in the play.
Damn.
Lunt played the lead of Marco Polo, and for my theater nerds out there, the play also starred Sanford Meisner, who established the Meisner technique.
The Meisner technique.
The Meisner
also,
technique.
Also, Marco
Polo. You knew that joke was coming, everyone.
I had to.
So sorry.
I'm so fucking sorry.
Once Albert got a taste of that acting success, he said, who needs a medical degree? And he decided to pursue an acting career.
I mean, I
can't
get
blame
that.
Him. Yeah.
I'm sure if I opened up a body and looked inside, I'd be like, I'm going to be an actor, not a doctor. Ew.
I would have felt that a while back. Now I'd be like, let me see that body.
Yeah. Now I'd rather be like a crime scene investigator.
Yeah. I think you and I would be really good at
it. I think so, too. We'd be like, you know, cracking like witty jokes to each other, but also being very like
professional
yes. And knowing exactly what What's going on?
Unfortunately, the detectives in this case
weren't as
great as I think we would have been.
Sure.
But we'll get there. Marco Millions ran for 3 months, closing in March, and in April, Albert met a lady. Esther Guarini was born in Chicago, Illinois in 1901.
Esther Guarini.
Esther Guarini. So a few years before Albert, she was an older woman by like 4 years.
Okay.
She had also done some acting, which is how she ended up in New York and met Albert. The two dated for a year before tying the knot on April 4th, 1929. And they went on to have 3 kids together, a daughter named Jan, followed by 2 sons, John and Benjamin. And people described Albert as such a family man, just a really good guy and very distinguished. That was something that came across a lot amongst people that knew him. They were just like, he was a dapper gentleman, very, very well, what's the word? Not well-bred, but like...
Well-rounded?
He definitely was well-rounded and just distinguished, yeah, like...
A gentleman.
Yes.
I don't know.
Yes.
There's a lot of words.
That we can't think of.
That we can't think of. People are like, this one, this one, this one. And we're like, what?
I like how when you try to give that example, you still didn't have words
I
like
don't,
this one,
I don't
this
have
one,
them.
This one. I don't either. Albert continued his work on the stage for several years in New York before making the move out west to Hollywood in 1937. He became a well-known and well-regarded character actor in a ton of films.
Wow.
Working with some of the biggest names in the industry like Clark Gable, Katharine Hepburn, and John Wayne. He was 6'3", 240 pounds at the time of his death, and had blue eyes and sandy blonde hair.
Ooh, he was thick. He sounds hot.
I think you might have liked him. He was really good with dialects, which aided in his success as an actor, and often played the villain, which he really seemed to enjoy. He said he found it more challenging than playing the hero, and said, quote, "Who wants to be America's sweetheart?" And I think most actors feel that same way because the villain is always the most interesting character.
There's a lot
to
more
play.
Layers there.
Yes.
Than just being like, I'm a good boy.
Oh, I'm going to fall in love with that person.
Let us all be kind. Let us all be straight.
Oh.
That's, I don't know.
They're typically the far more interesting roles,
right.
For sure. And it was for his leading role as the villain Dr. Thorkel in the 1940 film Dr. Cyclops that he's probably best known.
Dr. Thorkel.
Dr. Thorkel.
I thought you were going to say Dr. Quinn Medicine Woman. That's the wrong thing. So my friend Suze, I go over to her apartment to watch Drag Race every Friday now.
Mm-hmm.
And the only channel she gets on her Samsung TV is like, it's literally a Dr. Quinn Medicine Woman channel that only plays reruns of Dr. Quinn Medicine
what?
Woman.
What?
Yeah.
I didn't even know that existed.
Yeah.
How are you watching Drag Race on Dr. Quinn?
Drag Race.
Drag Race.
I mean, she has, like, you know, the apps and the...
Okay,
the,
okay.
Oh, my God. She has the streaming services that carry it that you can just watch it.
Yes,
so
okay.
So that's how we do it. But, like, when you flip on the TV...
Dr. Quinn.
DQ.
Jane Seymour.
Jane.
What's up? So in Dr. Cyclops, he plays a mad scientist that shrinks people when they threaten his power.
Ooh.
So think, like, Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, but evil. And intentional.
Oh.
Wait, are you too young for Honey, I Shrunk the Kids?
No. I know of it.
Okay.
And I think I know the Steve Martin version. Is that the only version? Or is it a...
All I know is the Rick Moranis.
Wasn't there a Steve Martin version?
I don't know.
Oh, there probably isn't. Those kids got tiny. I just thought of tiny babies.
We had a baby shower here for a friend a couple years ago. Mm-hmm. And one of the games involved these teeny tiny plastic babies.
I've seen those.
Because they hid them all through our house before they left. And so for the next like year and a half, we were finding tiny plastic babies in the weirdest spots.
I hate that.
Everywhere. In the freezer, at the bottom of our like cotton ball jar in the bathroom. We ran out of cotton balls and there was a baby everywhere.
And like you passed one in the toilet and you're like,
I didn't even know I was pregnant. It's like all those TLC shows.
Sorry.
We're a little sidetracked.
It's amazing.
So back to Dr. Cyclops. Part of what helped Albert win the role was the fact that he was kind of a big guy.
Mm-hmm.
Despite often playing the villain, though, people said he was basically a teddy bear. Alfred Lunt, who became a lifelong friend of Albert's, said, quote, he had a soul in which unkindness is wholly absent.
Oh, I'm falling in love with this
guy. I can tell. Those who knew him describe him as an intellectual. He loved reading classical literature. He wrote poetry and even got into sculpting. In 1944, Albert decided to give politics a go, because why not?
Sure.
He's doing everything else.
Everything.
He'd always had an interest in politics and felt he could be of good service. So in 1944, he ran for a seat in the California State Assembly and won by a landslide.
Whoa.
He was a Democrat and a huge supporter of liberal causes, especially women's rights. In particular, he championed the rights of unwed mothers, as well as those of women and children living in poverty. Hmm. And think about the time period. Women were expected to stay at home while men went to work. So if a man got a woman pregnant but refused to care for her or the child, she didn't have many options in terms of income. Mothers were frowned upon if they worked outside the home, because the belief was that, oh, you should be at home raising that child. But if that mother didn't have a man bringing in the money and she couldn't afford childcare so she could go to work, poverty was a likely result of that.
Of course.
The women's workforce did see a huge increase during World War II because someone needed to do the jobs of those men serving overseas in the war.
And they're making it work.
And that's why America was like, oh, yeah, I guess we should let women work. But even though women were now more welcome in the workplace, they still couldn't open a bank account in their own name. That right wouldn't be granted to women until the 1960s. Furthermore, women couldn't open a credit card in their own name until 1974.
Blarg.
And once World War II ended, a lot of those jobs that had been offered to women were then taken back and given to men as they returned home from the war. America was like, psych, you can't have this job after all.
Son of a bitch. They're like, the men are here.
Exactly.
Bye. Awful.
These were the issues Albert fought for, trying to make it so that unwed mothers, women living in poverty, children living in poverty stood a fighting chance. He also introduced a bill against capital punishment, but it was shot down because, according to the people who opposed the bill, quote, it would take the excitement out of a murder trial. Isn't that so fucked?
That's fucked up.
Yeah.
Girlfriends.
All of them. Albert served his 2-year term, but chose not to run for re-election, opting instead to focus on his acting career. I get it.
Get out of them politics,
yeah,
girl.
Get out of it. He did remain very outspoken politically, however, which will affect his career later on. But first, in 1949, he replaced actor Lee Cobb in the role of Willie Loman in the Broadway premiere of
Death of a Salesman.
Yep. Lee Cobb is credited with originating the role, but Albert, along with a couple of other actors, all filled in as his replacement at some point, and Albert received critical acclaim for his performance.
Great. I mean, that's a great play. And
it's
a great role.
Yeah, it's a great role. And that was
the Broadway debut of...
Like, Arthur Miller is in the audience watching you.
Miller.
Crazy.
Arthur. Miller, comma, Arthur.
Comma, Arthur.
Fuck.
For those not familiar with the play, it's about an aging traveling salesman named Willie Loman, whose world seems to be crumbling around him. First, he gets a pay cut, then he gets fired, he attempts suicide on multiple occasions, and then at the end of the play, he does die by suicide in the hopes that his family will benefit from the insurance payout. Apparently, Albert was so convincing that when his 9-year-old son came to see him in the show, he ran backstage afterwards to make sure his dad was still alive. Albert continued his work on screen, both in movies and film, including East of Eden with James Dean, for which Dean was nominated for an Oscar, although he never knew it because he died before those nominations came out. But in the mid-1950s, McCarthyism was sweeping through Hollywood.
Here we go. Yes. Red scares.
And major names were being blacklisted and forced out of jobs. Albert could not stand watching this hunt for communists. He thought the whole thing was ridiculous, and he publicly denounced Joseph McCarthy's tactics and said the man was insane. And then he started getting death threats.
Yep. There they come.
Albert was one of the lucky ones. He wasn't technically blacklisted, as so many of his colleagues were, but he was graylisted in Hollywood, which meant that although he couldn't work at the major studios, he could still work for the much smaller independent
indie
ones, like think B-movie kind of things.
Okay.
His career did slow down considerably during this time. He appeared in episodes of a few TV shows, gave lectures at colleges, but his saving grace was his theater background.
Yeah. to the theater.
He was able to focus his work on the stage, which is exactly where he was when tragedy struck one of his children.
No.
In April of 1957, while Albert was in Palm Beach, Florida, appearing in the Agatha Christie play Witness for the Prosecution, his 16-year-old son John was at the family's home in Hastings-on-Hudson, New York. John was the middle child. He was a junior at Hastings High School, where he was really popular. He enjoyed running track and was particularly interested in music and science. And earlier that month, he won a prize in the science fair. He was a really smart kid.
I won the science fair.
What was your experiment?
So I got, what was it? I got honorable mention in the fourth grade because I did a project about the cell.
Like cells in the body?
Cells, yeah, like body cells.
Body cells. Body cells.
I'm trying to think there's a name for that because there's also plant cells, but
sure.
Like animal cells.
Okay.
There we go. And so my mom and I made a jello mold in a round container, and we put, you know, an open fruit in the middle as the nucleus and like little grapes as the mitochondria. And
I'm getting the whole image here.
Yeah.
He's really painting a picture. He's doing a lot of hand motions.
my face. and I got honorable mention.
So you didn't win?
Honorable mention, Kate. I didn't place, but I almost did. I did much better in the social studies fairs.
There were social studies fairs?
Yeah. Oh, you know, for science fair once, I did make my own perfumes.
I'm obsessed.
Yeah.
How'd that go? Did you get a ribbon?
I got first place.
Hey!
For that.
Did you make that up? Because I feel like that would have been your story before.
No.
Okay.
Why?
Well, because you were like, I won the science fair, but then that one.
Well,
really
I'm trying to remember. There were different schools, different fairs, different projects. Fourth grade was my first ever science fair.
Oh, okay.
Then later in life, you know, in middle school and high school.
I'm going to be like, yesterday.
And yesterday, I also placed.
I made my own perfume, which you kind of are right now.
I know.
Kevin smells really good today.
Scentbird, if you want to sponsor us.
Yeah, I mean, this isn't an ad, but if you wanted to be.
I mean, I actually really like it. They sent me another sample. I haven't gotten it yet.
It smells so good.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Anyway, science fairs are fun. Continue.
Yeah, I don't really know how to transition because what happens next is not fun.
It's not good.
John had been experimenting for the past year with constructing a silencer for the .22 caliber rifle he owned. John's parents were aware he owned the gun, though it's unclear why they allowed him to have such a dangerous weapon in the first place. Mm-hmm. Around 2 p.m. on the afternoon of April 18th, 1957, Esther, John's mother and Albert's wife, heard what sounded like a gunshot coming from her son's bedroom.
No.
She ran to check on John and make sure everything was okay, but things were definitely not okay. Esther found her son lying on the floor of his bedroom across his rifle. A single bullet had entered his right eye, killing him instantly. In his left hand, he was clutching a cloth that police believed he was using to either clean the gun or to experiment with as a silencer. His death was ruled accidental. The gun had gone off while John was holding it. He was not trying to kill himself.
Oh, it was. Okay.
Yeah.
I see.
I can't even imagine his mom walking in on that scene.
Oh, my God.
That is horrific. Albert raced back to New York from Florida to be with his family, and though he did continue working after the death of his son, his career did start to wind down.
Sure.
It was also around this time, in either the late 50s or early 60s, that Albert became a patient of Dr. Max Jacobson. Though I couldn't find a specific reason why he started seeing him, Dr. Max Jacobson was a New York physician who was incredibly popular with celebrities, in particular President John F. Kennedy. Mm. Jacobson's nickname among those in the know was Dr. Feelgood. And he was called that because he gave his patients vitamin shots that gave them huge boosts of energy and allowed them to withstand their grueling schedules.
Sure. Let me guess. It was like crack or...
Pretty much. Kennedy sought the aid of Dr. Jacobson numerous times in the early 60s to help him with his severe back pain. Mm-hmm. When the Food and Drug Administration raised the alarm about what was included in these vitamin shots, Kennedy famously stated, quote, "I don't care if it's horse piss, it works." And what the FDA found was that these shots consisted of amphetamines, methamphetamines, animal hormones, bone marrow, human placenta, painkillers, steroids, and multivitamins, just to round it all out.
Just to put a little icing on the top.
Get
of
that zinc in
drug
there.
Drug cake. Ugh.
Side effects of these injections included hyperactivity, impaired judgment, nervousness, and wild mood swings. All the things you want in a world leader, obviously.
Of course.
Director Cecil B. DeMille even brought Jacobson with him to Egypt as his personal physician while he was shooting the film The Ten Commandments. Other famous clients of Dr. Jacobson included Lauren Bacall, Ingrid Bergman, Humphrey Bogart, Marilyn Monroe, Hedy Lamarr, Elizabeth Taylor, and Tennessee Williams, just to name a small percentage.
Oh my God, everybody was just getting shot up with drugs.
He was keeping them high on meth. Like, they were loving it. And Albert was no different. Perhaps he started seeing the doctor to combat the effects of aging because he is starting to get a little older. Maybe it was to help him cope with the depression he experienced after losing his son. Mm-hmm. It's unclear. But he told his son, Benjamin, who was a young adult by this point, that these vitamin cocktails he was receiving from Jacobson had really helped his energy, of course.
Yeah.
In fact, he was able to stay up 24, 36, even 40 hours at a time.
That's not healthy.
When he wanted to. Why would anyone want to do that?
Right.
I can't think of a single scenario where I would enjoy that.
No.
And according to Benjamin, his father entered somewhat of a downward spiral once he started seeing Dr. Feelgood.
Okay.
Not only was he a patient of his, but Albert began working alongside Jacobson as his medical and lab assistant, determined to make use of that pre-med education, I guess. At the beginning of 1964, Albert and Esther separated. No real explanation is given as to why. It could have been Albert's drug use. Maybe it was the toll losing their son had taken on each of them emotionally. But in February of that year, Albert went to Juarez, Mexico, and got a divorce. This came up in our Jane Mansfield story because she got a divorce in Juarez.
Yeah, I remember that.
So I looked into it. And the reason it was such a popular place to get a divorce there is because it was cheaper than the U.S., like a lot cheaper.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't have to go through a divorce hearing. Basically, the judge would just sign off on it. And only one spouse had to be present.
Wow.
Yeah. In a New York Times article from 1970, the city of Juarez reported that it granted about 45,000 divorces a year to U.S. citizens, and more than half came from New York. And Albert was one of them, just a month and a half before they would have celebrated their 35th wedding anniversary.
Oh, man. And he just goes and divorces her.
Albert divorced Esther, citing incompatibility.
Hmm.
It took you 35 years to decide you weren't compatible? It makes me think there was more going on here.
There's more under the story, yeah.
He did find love again with former fashion model Geraldine Saunders.
Mm-hmm.
Geraldine Saunders was a badass, so I just want to talk about her
for
a
minute.
Yeah,
let's talk it.
She was a model for about 20 years. Then when she felt like she was getting too old to model, she got a job as a cruise ship hostess by essentially lying on her application. They wanted someone who spoke Italian and Spanish in addition to English, and they wanted someone who knew how to play bridge because that was a popular activity on cruises.
Boats.
And Geraldine said, ciao, hola, yeah, I can totally speak all those languages, and I love bridge, it's my fave, but she did not know how to play and she did not speak any other languages. But she got hired, and in just 2 years was promoted to cruise director. She wrote about her experiences in a book called The Love Boats, which inspired the long-running series The Love
Boat. Oh, my God.
She is the creator of that show. That happened in the 70s after her relationship with Albert, but I just wanted to mention
that. Yeah, I love that.
Later in her life, she wrote a nationally syndicated horoscope column, which she did up until her death in 2019. But in the mid to late 60s, Geraldine was all about Albert. According to her, the two were engaged, and the wedding was planned for the summer of 1968. Earlier that year, Albert signed on to the film The Wild Bunch, shooting in Mexico. The film starred William Holden and Ernest Borgnine, and Albert played Harrigan, the tough railroad detective. According to the film's stars and its director, Albert was the life of the party, which I imagine if he was hopped up on meth, like, yeah,
of
he probably was.
We all were.
Albert was the entertainment in between scenes, telling stories as they all sat around waiting for the next shot to get set up. He completed filming his scenes in April of 1968 and collected his pay for The Wild Bunch in cash, which was $30,000. In today money, that would be close to 272 grand. The reason he wanted cash is because he and Geraldine were about to close a deal on a house in Los Angeles, and Albert felt he could use the large sum of cash as bargaining leverage for the house.
I see.
Back in LA, Albert was staying in an apartment at 1731 North Normandy Avenue. It was meant to be a temporary residence while the house he and Geraldine were purchasing went through escrow. She had another place, so she wasn't staying with him in the apartment. It really was just a space for him while he and Geraldine worked out all the details of the wedding and moving in together, all of that. Mm-hmm. And he was also preparing for a role in Fiddler on the Roof and needed a quiet place where he could work.
Fiddler on the Roof.
According to Geraldine, he chose the apartment on Normandy because a friend of his managed it. So that's easy. He doesn't have to put in a bunch of applications everywhere. He's just like, hey, can I stay here a few weeks? Mm-hmm. So I don't think he had a ton of stuff in the place in terms of personal belongings. He had the $30,000 along with another $40,000 in cash from television roles that he had recently completed.
Okay.
And he had camera equipment and a tape recorder that he was using to rehearse for Fiddler. On the evening of May 2nd, Albert and Geraldine had a little date night. They went to see the new play, The Latent Heterosexual, starring Zero Mostel at the Huntington Hartford Theater, which is now the Montalban Theater in Hollywood. Hmm. It had run for a few weeks in Dallas before transferring to Los Angeles, and this was opening night. So it was a fun night of celebration and entertainment. All the fancy schmancy people are there. And Geraldine and Albert had a lovely time. And before Albert returned to the Normandy apartment, they made plans to meet up the following evening. But when
what is that play about?
It's about a guy who's gay, but says that he's straight for tax purposes, if I'm not mistaken.
There's this movie, I'm not going to know the title or really anything about it, but
great.
I always see these, no, I know, throwaway comment, but I always see these social media posts of one of the scenes from it, and it's like two, I think, straight guys who are together trying to not be drafted for war or something.
Mm.
They get in a fight with this lady, and she comes over to their house and is stomping on their garden. And the one guy is like, you bitch, you're ruining my panties. And she's like, they're marigolds. And then he goes, I may not know my flowers, but I know a bitch when I see one.
Amazing.
I'll send it to you.
Great. So the two have plans for the following evening, but when the next day came and Albert failed to show and Geraldine was unable to get in touch with him, she found it strange. And this brings us to where we started this episode. When by the following Sunday, Geraldine still hadn't heard from her fiancé, she went to his apartment.
Yeah.
Friends had left notes on his door. She had slid her own note underneath the door earlier that day, which was still there when the manager let her in. It's unclear if the manager who let her in is the same friend Albert knew that managed the building. When they got to the bathroom door, which was locked, mm-hmm. they busted their way in and Geraldine was met with a gruesome and bizarre sight at which she immediately fainted. Her 62-year-old fiancé, Albert Decker, was kneeling in the bathtub, naked. He had a hypodermic needle sticking out of each arm, and the needles were described as, quote, dirty and well used.
Ah. Oh.
Oh, if
oh,
you're
I don't like that.
If you're upset now, I don't know if you're going to handle the rest. A rope was tied one end around his neck and the other around the shower rod. According to the coroner's report, however, the rope around his neck was not tight enough to have strangled him, although I've seen other reports online saying it was really tight. So I don't know why the discrepancy. Mm. There was a scarf tied over Albert's eyes. It's described as a, quote, woman's type scarf. So I think that just means like the kind women would wear in that time period, like around their hair or maybe like around their neck. And one report I read said he was wearing women's lingerie. I could not verify that anywhere. And every other report I read said he was naked. So I don't know where the women's lingerie came from.
Maybe like misinterpreting the thing around his eyes.
That's what I was thinking. Inside Albert's mouth was something like a horse's bit. It was a rubber ball with a metal wire running through it, and it had chains attached to it like reins that were tightly tied behind Albert's head. There was a leather belt around his neck, one around his chest, and a third around his waist, which was tied with a rope that went down to his ankles, where it was tied in a knot, and then the rope continued up his side, wrapped around his waist several times and was held in his hands.
Mm.
Albert's wrists were tightly clasped in a pair of regulation handcuffs. In the book Tales of Hollywood the Bazaar by John Austin, where a lot of this description comes from, it does not say if he was handcuffed behind his back or in front. But several other accounts I read said his hands are handcuffed behind his back. I found one photo online claiming it's his death photo. And in the photo, the man does have his hands handcuffed behind his back. We'll talk more about that photo in a second. There was a key attached to the handcuffs. Two leather thongs were stretched between the leather belts around Albert's neck and chest. On his right buttock were two needle punctures, and above them, the word WHIP, like W-H-I-P, was written in red lipstick, along with a drawing of a sun. There were also sun rays drawn around his nipples. Kevin just did a weird little dance with that. I don't think that's...
I'm sorry, it was inappropriate. Yes. Sorry. I don't know why I'm getting weird about this.
Because it's fucking crazy. On his throat were the words, make me suck. And on his chest were the words, slave and cocksucker. Below his belly button was the drawing of a vagina. And again, all of those are in red lipstick. Detective Daniel K. Stewart described Albert's body as being in, quote, complicated knots because of the way he was tied up and his position in the tub. Lividity had turned the lower half of his body purple. Just a refresher, I've talked about it on here before, but it's been a while. Lividity occurs when the heart stops pumping blood, and since blood isn't flowing, gravity pulls it down to the lowest point of the body where it pools, turning the skin a deep bluish purple. And it's really important in forensics because it can help determine time of death and the position in which the person died. And it can also tell a medical examiner what might have caused the death because different toxins can produce different colors of lividity. Based on the condition of Albert's body, the coroner on the scene determined that Albert had died sometime Friday night, the night he was supposed to meet up with Geraldine. As detectives conducted their initial investigation of the apartment, they noted there were no signs of forced entry and labeled the death a suicide. Deputy Coroner Herbert McRoy disputed this, however, saying, quote, we have no information that this individual planned to take his own life, so it will be listed as an accidental death. This is certainly a strange death, but just because there was a rope around his neck does not mean that he committed suicide. That was the coroner.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Thomas Noguchi, a.k.a. Coroner to the Stars, he's come up before in our episodes and he will definitely come up again. He put forth a theory that Albert died of autoerotic asphyxiation. The official cause of death on Albert's death certificate is asphyxiation due to suffocation and constriction of neck by ligatures.
So that was the cause of death?
Yes.
It wasn't whatever he was injected with?
Well, unfortunately, because a few days had passed, they were unable to determine what, if anything, he was injected
with. Oh, fuck.
Yeah. Geraldine, once she finally came to, I mean, I would pass out too if I saw that, wasn't buying that Albert's death was accidental or that he voluntarily bound and gagged himself. She was unaware of any behavior Albert might be involved in regarding sadomasochism or bondage, and even Al's closest friends said he wasn't into anything, quote, kinky.
But how would they really know?
Because you never really know a person.
You don't really know. And if that was like, you know, maybe he hired dominatrixes every once in a while to come over and fulfill some kind of sexual fantasy or...
There was a theory that I don't even know that they actually pursued this, but there was a theory that he might have hired a sex worker.
Right.
And the detectives, for whatever reason, determined, oh, well, it was probably a male sex worker. I don't know why they thought that. And supposedly they went to an area that was known to have a lot of male sex workers and asked about Albert, but no one knew him. And I'm like, at this time period, I don't know anyone who's just going to randomly talk to a cop and be like, hey, I'm a sex worker.
No, not
and
at that
yeah,
time.
That guy totally died while I was in there. Like, so I don't know
how
they could fully investigate that if they even did. I will say, though, that a woman whose name I could not find in any source came forward and told investigators that she was Albert's ex-girlfriend and she had engaged in bondage scenes with Albert, but was not with him the night of his death. Again, I haven't seen her name listed anywhere. Don't even know if that was true. Don't even know anything if he had that girlfriend. An investigation of Albert's apartment turned up a lot of stuff.
Oh,
leather and rubber clothes, whips, chains, women's clothing, and an extensive collection of pornography that featured both men and women bound and gagged and in various positions.
Okay.
There was also a list on the desk in the apartment in Albert's handwriting of various bondage techniques, I guess you could say.
Mm-hmm.
Things like hot wax brushed on nipples and genitals. Ow. Just even reading that hurt. Dildos of all shapes and sizes. The buttocks as a pincushion. And remember, he had two puncture wounds. Forcing the victim to tie himself up. The list goes on and on, but you get the gist.
Sure.
And according to John Austin's book I mentioned earlier, Tales of Hollywood the Bizarre, there were further investigations conducted that were never publicized, which revealed Albert received Chinese acupuncture to his sexual organs and participated in sadomasochism with friends, which sounds like an app for your phone. Sadomasochism with friends.
S&M with friends.
Download it. I'm just kidding.
No, I'm not. Me personally, I'm not into that kink, but, you know, okay.
Right,
whatever.
Exactly.
Like, it doesn't sound like he was hurting anyone or
exactly
doing anything bad. Like, whatever, it's his kink.
Yeah. Detectives were pretty quick to close the case, mm-hmm. stating that based on the items they found in the apartments and the fact that the bathroom door was locked from the inside, Albert had done this to himself, though likely had not intended it to result in death. They didn't take fingerprints. They didn't take photos. They were just like, oh, the door was locked from the inside. But
it also seems like the subject matter of this, of what that could have been, maybe put them off. And they just needed
to
close it and just be like, oh, no,
we're done. Yep.
Fuck it.
There are a lot more questions than answers.
Yeah.
In John Austin's book, he writes, quote, although the chain lock mounted on the inside door jamb was not activated, no one but Decker could have locked the door. Unfortunately, there are no photos of the door or the lock. And if it wasn't chained, what kind of lock was it? Detectives
right.
don't say. And this book is the only place where I read the chain was not activated. Every other report, including one from the Los Angeles Times, stated that the door was chained from inside the bathroom, and there were no windows in the bathroom. So people online have been quick to point out that even if that were the case, someone with a thin enough arm could have reached in to chain the lock before leaving. That's not impossible.
No.
Because there is that give.
Yeah.
And the front door, though it was locked, was not bolted. And that's something that a person could not do if they were leaving the apartment. They could not bolt it and then leave. So just some interesting things to consider. And although investigators found women's clothing in the apartment, there's no mention of them finding red lipstick. But the words on his body were definitely written in red lipstick. So where did that come from? Or where did it go?
I mean, in my mind, like, maybe he... maybe this, whatever they were into, was happening in a different part of the apartment. And maybe he went into the bathroom like that and locked. I don't know. I'm just thinking through. Go ahead.
But my point is, could someone have taken that red lipstick and left with it? Because they never found it.
Well, yeah. I mean, I'm of the mindset here that he was probably accidentally murdered during a...
It's possible. I mentioned this death photo that is supposedly of Albert Decker. It's mm-hmm. the only one I've been able to find, and I'm just not convinced it's him. For one thing, it's not taken of him in the tub. He's lying on the floor. And if it is him, the leather belts have been removed. If you are a crime scene photographer, and your one job is to take a photo of the scene, why would you move the body and remove the items that had the body bound before you took the photo? It doesn't make sense.
That is weird.
I really think they were like, oh, the door was locked from the inside. Well, it had to be him. The person in this photo has his hands bound behind his back, and you also only see his backside. You don't see his face. I've stared at this person's butt longer than I care to mention, and I don't see anything written on it. It's not a very clear image, granted, and it's not really in focus. It's in black and white. I'm going to show it to you.
Okay.
Furthermore, it simply does not look like the body of a 62-year-old, 6'3", 240-pound man. This person appears to be younger, from what I can tell. Not very tall and pretty lean. He's kind of thin. I don't think it's him. I'm going to show Kevin the photo here. Granted, it's blurry, but...
Yeah, that is pretty blurry. But yeah, it does look like a younger person.
Mm-hmm. And a thin person.
Yeah. I don't know, Kate. That's tough.
Yeah, I don't think that's him.
Also, like, if it's a crime scene photo, wouldn't it be a little more clear? I don't know.
You would think. And this is the only thing that I could find. So as far as I know, there is no photo of the death scene. Mm-hmm. If someone finds one, please send us a link because I want to take a look at it. But it just makes me think, I mean, they didn't do a thorough investigation of this. They made up their mind that it was one thing and washed their hands of it. Mm-hmm. If we're going with the autoerotic asphyxiation theory and Albert's hands were cuffed behind his back rather than in front, how does that help him achieve orgasm?
Yeah.
I'm legit asking because I don't understand. I'm not part of the kink community, so I don't know if that is like a common thing. This comes up in the David Carradine case from years ago, who was found hanging in his closet. His hands were bound, but there was discrepancy of whether they were behind his back or on top of his head. Mm-hmm. Again, I don't know. I don't know how that works. I'm just being honest.
I mean, there's something to it. I don't know what it is. I mean, I know that it's not achievable.
Okay. I did scroll through some forums online, and based on what I found, it doesn't seem like this kind of scene, the way he was tied up, is uncommon. And many people on these threads said if a person is determined enough, they could manage to tie themselves up in the way Albert had. So I don't know. Geraldine also didn't know. Like I said before, she had no idea Albert was into this kind of thing. And this is her fiancé, who she is 1 month away from marrying.
Oh, wow.
And they're about to close on a house. So I can't even imagine finding out something like that.
Sure.
In such a horrific way. Geraldine refused to believe the idea that Albert had done this to himself and urged detectives to look deeper, especially since the $70,000 in cash was missing.
Oh.
Yeah, I was saving that little bit for
you. Oh.
And so was all that fancy, expensive camera equipment Al had been keeping in the apartment. The detectives checked all of Al's bank records to see if he'd deposited any cash. He had not. Geraldine believed someone Albert knew must have come to the door and he let them in. She said he was very trusting. She said that friend of Albert's that managed the building, which was the reason Al was renting there in the first place, mm-hmm. She said he disappeared after Al's death, and she felt he always had something to do with it. Which I could see if they are friends, and that guy like would hang out in Albert's apartment and notice that there's cash lying around, and he's got like some fancy, expensive equipment. Yeah, I could see that. I could also see if he does manage the building, then he would know how to stage a scene because he could use his keys or whatever to lock doors that needed to be locked. I'm just speculating.
I don't know. I feel like you'd have to know something about S&M and putting in someone in that position to do that. Does that make sense?
It does. And that's why I think if Albert was into this stuff, which it sounds like he was.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think there's a question about that now.
It's possible that friend did know that.
Right. Maybe he was like in a, I don't want to say a relationship, but maybe they had like a sexual thing.
I mean, who knows? Later on, after the case had been closed, one of the detectives admitted to Geraldine that he thought Albert had been murdered. She tried to get the police to reverse the accident ruling, but they wouldn't, and the case has remained closed.
Damn it.
And as if losing her fiancé wasn't awful enough, just 2 years after Albert's death, Geraldine's daughter from a previous marriage died of hypoglycemia, which prompted her to write the book Hypoglycemia, The Disease Your Doctor Won't Treat. That was published in, her daughter died in 1970. I think her book was published in 1980.
Okay.
And this is just a fun fact about Geraldine. When she was 89 years old, she was on the TLC show Extreme Cougar Wives with her much younger boyfriend who was like in his 40s. I just thought
that
was fun. I have
to go watch that immediately. Oh my God, Extreme Cougar Wives.
I don't know what I think happened here. Did he invite someone over to get a little freaky and things went too far? Very possible.
I think that's what happened. That's my takeaway from this.
Because it's possible that like once Albert became unresponsive, that other person freaked out. Yeah. Maybe they left but helped themselves to some cash and camera equipment on the way out. It's possible.
I mean, Or maybe that was the motive, you know, robbery and then put him in that weird position.
Possibly. I also thought it could be possible that if it was another person in the entertainment industry, there's possibly stuff on that camera that maybe they were using.
Maybe
it,
they didn't.
And they didn't want that revealed. So yeah, it really could be anything. Or was it exactly what authorities said it was? He was alone. He tied himself up and things went too far. I don't know.
I don't think so.
I will say there's a quote on Wikipedia, so take that with a grain of salt, from actor RJ Armstrong saying that when Albert went down to Mexico to shoot The Wild Bunch, he, quote, showed up with a 13-year-old girl he described as his wife, telling people that he was a medical doctor and that after filming, he would retire from acting to help impoverished Africans. I, of course, had to look this up because I was like, what? This actor, RJ Armstrong, did not work on The Wild Bunch, and there are no accounts of Albert bringing a 13-year-old girl to set, and he had no plans to retire because he had projects lined up after filming completed. So I just want to throw that in there for those who might be out there and go, well, this person had this to say about his character. That quote's not true.
Mm-hmm.
Paul Lucas, a friend of Albert's and an actor who had appeared with him in a couple of movies, refused to believe the coroner's ruling and told reporters, quote, Al would never leave the world in such a terrible shambles. He was a man of culture and breeding. But again, you don't always know what goes on behind closed doors.
Mm-hmm.
Albert's own son, Benjamin, said years later about his dad, quote, his death was the result of an accident that was between or occurred during a relationship of two consenting adults. There are some things that are private. One of those things is a person's private life. As long as what they do does not affect in a pejorative fashion the lives of others, they have a right to be able to do whatever they wish to do. It's that simple. I just thought that was interesting for his son to say that because maybe he knew his dad better than most.
Right.
But if it was consensual and his death was the result of an accident, then someone's not coming forward. And I could understand their reasons for not wanting to, but that's still really shitty.
Mm-hmm.
And then to rob him?
Mm.
Unfortunately, his death overshadowed his impressive career. He did earn a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame back in 1960.
Okay.
And family and friends said he was always a generous and compassionate man who was much beloved. And that's the bizarre case of Albert Dekker.
That's crazy.
Yeah. Let us know what you think.
Yes.
On Instagram, Facebook, or YouTube at...
I almost said Patreon podcast. Oh my God, no. Horrorwood podcast.
There it is. Or you can send us an email at...
Horrorwoodpodcast@gmail.com.
Or you could be like, Baby Legs Sinclair.
Baby Legs Sinclair.
And join the Patreon at...
Patreon.com/Horrorwood Podcast.
That's it for today.